This podcast was recorded at Hartford Street Zen Center, Isanji, in San Francisco. Please help support our temple by making a donation at hscc.org.
We are continually faced with a real dilemma in Zen practice. Because Zen practice, as I understand it anyway, is about bridging the gap, both in ourselves and with each other, with our ancestors and with our descendants. And the practices and teachings of Zen are a continuous attempt to maintain this dialogue. And this dialogue, I'm afraid, has become somewhat confused. For many of us. We no longer share the same worldview or same cosmology as our ancestors. And so it's rather difficult to know how to communicate with them. They actually don't understand us, and we don't understand them. The way in which we use language is so fundamentally different than the way in which they use language that we no longer understand what they're saying. In the ancient world, there were sacred languages, and those languages were cultivated, developed to tune us into aspects of our consciousness that our everyday language is not able to reach. So for us, it's difficult to understand what those old Zen teachers were about, what they were trying to tell us even. We don't share the same world or the same worldview. And however, they have given us the clues about how to do it. This is what the practice is about. The practice is as a kind of puzzle, which our consciousness actually knows how to put back together. And if we settle ourselves into it, we actually have the capacity to put the puzzle together. And the joy, the real joy of practice, is in that investigation, that exploration of the teaching and of the practice that puts the puzzle of consciousness together. that wakes us up, that turns us on, tunes us in. There are two avenues of approach to doing this. One involves language, and one involves not language. So we have Zazen, which involves not language. But the curious thing is that the not language is the entryway into language. Like slipping underneath to find a way through. So we have to find a way to disengage from the language of our ordinary mind. It's not that there's anything wrong with the language of ordinary mind, it's simply that there's no way to approach the power of consciousness at this more fundamental level through ordinary language. It works perfectly fine within the world of its being, but it cannot be used as an approach to this other dimension of our consciousness. I'd say one of the fundamental secrets or tricks of Zen practice is to take ordinary language and flip it inside out. And the only way to take language and flip it inside out is to rediscover it in the emptiness of Zazen practice. It re-emerges in a new way. I would say that there is a continuous dialogue that's going on between language and not language, between silence and its manifestation through the senses. And language is the flower of the mind organ. The seeing is the flower of the eye. Hearing is the flower of the ear. And language is the flower of the mind. And when we explore it, the mystery is that when we explore it, it actually disappears. If you actually explore seeing, it dissolves into not seeing. Hearing dissolves into not hearing. And language dissolves into silence. I think this is what we mean when we say that Zazen is the gateway into spiritual life. And as we know, those of us who practice in any way, when we come to sit zazen, we experience the resistance of our senses. Our eyes want to continue to see, our ears want to continue to hear, our thoughts want to continue to flower. And we've woven our senses together in such a way that it creates a kind of object that is hard to dissolve. And yet the whole function of Zazen practice is to dissolve the objective images that we have created. We have the senses are continuously renewing themselves, of course, because existence is continuously renewing itself. So it has to let go, it has to continuously let go to take in, to absorb the next sight or sound, thought. But our habit patterns are always formulating those images of our senses into set objects, which then block us or imprison us. In formal Zen practice, we have what we call the turning word or the turning phrase. This is a way in which the Zen people and adepts found how to use language, how to turn language so that it reveals the other side of itself. This is what I mean when I say that we've lost this the sense of how to communicate with our ancestors, because the ancestors knew how to do this and we don't know how to do this. I always know when I'm in the presence of a turning word, because as I'm saying it, I see its opposite at the same time. And it's like a door, and it goes in both directions. And it's a kind of, there's a kind of joy, and there's a kind of cosmic joke about it. Because as you're saying it, you see that what you're saying is the opposite of what you're trying to say. there's a real delight. There's a real delight in it because you're not held by the language. The language has a life of its own and allows you to be entertained by it. And I think that this is very important because that the practice, the spiritual practice, is a very demanding process, and we get caught up in it. The process itself it's hard to stay with the energy of it, and so we tend to clamp down. And you can see this in various, in many serious students. It's kind of, if you look at it from the surface, it looks very rigid. It's very tight. What's actually happening, of course, is that they're trying to keep from being blown away by inner psychic forces. But if we're not involved in the process itself, if we're just looking at it from the outside, it just looks austere and puritanical in our society. When our society looks at it sees a kind of puritanical image. And certainly from the perspective of our society, when we look at Zen practice, we see a kind of world withdrawal, or we interpret it as passive or as unapproachable. We don't know how to approach it. So we don't see its liveliness or its humor or its sensitivity. Then it makes it very difficult to have this dialogue between those who are practicing and those who are not practicing. Because they're having such a different conception, a different experience of the world. actually difficult to give a kind of public talk anymore. I've given talks in many different contexts. It's very difficult to get, for me anyway, to give a kind of public talk because, again, of this, I feel so strongly this inability to find a language to communicate that is not that keeps alive this experience that I'm feeling. The language, our language is controlled by our society, not ours. That's why, again, there's a kind of private language in practice. It's a language that the people who are practicing develop with each other through their practice. That is, you take a word out of a story and you start to talk about that word, and then you can put it back into the story. And then next month, in another context, you can pull out a word out of that story, which then links you to that story. And even though you've changed the word, by the way, by describing it, by looking at it in a particular way, in a particular context, it actually is a different word than it was before you started to talk about it from a practice point of view. And then you can start to play with those words. This takes time. This takes a dialogue between us all for that to develop. In this way, we keep the language alive. We keep those images alive in ourselves and in our consciousness. It's actually what the way in which we can transmit them from one generation to the next. This generation hands this image to me. I look at this image. I give it to you. It can't pass from here to here without going through me. And it can't go through me without going through you. We share it. We share the language. We share the images. We share the pattern. And if it is to be transmitted to another generation, it has to go through us. It's very much like having children. You can't skip a generation. The women of just this generation have to produce the child for the next generation. Yeah, this generation. In the same way, if we are going to practice, we are the ones who have to practice to transmit it to our descendants. We can't wait for somebody else to do it. There is nobody else to do it. And this is an important task. This is something of importance that we should dedicate ourselves to, we should focus on, we should give meaning and structure to it. Create a place like Isanji is it's a real responsibility. and it has the capacity to hold that the heart, Isan's heart. This Isanji should hold, be holding Isan's heart. But to do that, we need to practice together. Isan is not Isan, this person. Isan is the culmination of this life of practice. He had a teaching which he received through his direct experience, which he handed to us. And of course we need the structure and the organization and the building and all that stuff. But all that stuff has a purpose. That purpose is to hold, maintain, and to transmit teaching. If we forget that purpose, if we forget the essence of why it was formed in the first place, to maintain it is to lose it. In that case, you should take it apart. You should only maintain it, maintain the spirit so that it can be transmitted. Because this is the life of practice. This is why we do it. We don't do it to hold expensive San Francisco property. This kind of exploration is at the center of what Zen practice is about. Zen practice is a continuous critique of itself. It's a continuous investigation into the depth of consciousness. To reveal or to open up, once again, to open up this dialogue with our ancestors and our descendants. Myself, I am completely, I must admit, I am baffled at why it's gotten so confused. Why we have forgotten what we are here to do. There are many things to do in this world, and there are many things that need our attention. But I want to remind us that one of the things that we need to do is to transmit this teaching. It actually is a value. It actually has the power to wake us up, to awaken us. So we have the opportunity to do that, and I would just like to encourage us to make use of that opportunity as much as possible. to remain in dialogue with each other about what, how to do this. How is it done? Without just assuming that we know how it's done or how it was done in Japan or China or India. How are we going to find a way to do it? In with an old Zen story about a Chinese Zen teacher who sees one of his disciples doing Zazen. And you would think that he'd be very happy, his disciple doing Zazen. And since that's what Zen people do. But he actually confronts his student. What are you doing? Why are you doing Zazen? I mean, it should be the most obvious thing. Anyway, you know, and they've been doing this for a long time. So this isn't like somebody who just walked in the door. Anyway, he says to his student who's been doing Zazen for years, why are you doing Zazen? The student says, I want to become a Buddha. I'm doing Zazen to become a Buddha. Well, that's a very noble thing. But his student, his teacher doesn't buy it. And he just goes over and picks up a tile and starts to rub on the tile. Doesn't say anything to the student. The student can't not notice that his teacher's over there rubbing a tile. What are you doing? Why are you over there rubbing that tile? He says, I'm rubbing this tile to make it into a mirror. But you can't make a mirror by rubbing a tile. The student says, she says, oh, is that right? And you can't make a Buddha by sitting with Zazen. Anyway, if you looked at this story, you know, outside of the story, you might say, well, this is a criticism of sitting Zazen. And the teacher is telling the student that he can't become Buddha by sitting Zazen. Kind of logical look at the story, but it's not what he's saying at all. What he is noting to the student is that the thing that is there's a block. The block is the way he thinks about what he's doing. Not what he's doing, but what he thinks about what he's doing. So we don't, it's a mistake to think that we do Zazen to become something else. Even if that something else is Buddha. Zazen is the expression of the awakened mind. It's not to get to the awakened mind. is the expression of the awakening. It's a complete flip. You're doing exactly the same thing for exactly the wrong reason. So doing it and not doing it are exactly the same. Where is the difference? How do we make use of this practice in a way that is an expression of the awakened mind and not as an excuse for not being an expression of the awakened mind? So if you think that you're doing it to become Buddha, you're doing it for the wrong reason. You are actually not doing the practice. Even though you're doing the practice, you're not doing the practice. These shifts in our consciousness are extremely important. And without the practice of Zazen, we wouldn't see that the practice of Zazen is not Buddha. From the way in which Buddhists look at their world and their experiences in this in a fourfold way. This fourfold way of looking is inherent in every aspect of Buddhist life. This fourfold way has been described in many different ways, but it comes down to form and emptiness. If a two, it becomes a four. That is only a one. So, Buddhist counting is very... Buddhist mathematics is very strange. So, we have basically form and emptiness. We have a dualistic world. The mind creates a dualistic world. The way it functions, it can't function any other way. It always sees things in opposites. It's the nature of consciousness. It's the nature of the way the eye sees, the ear hears, the way our skin feels, and so on. It's inherent in its functioning. But the inheritance of its functioning, there is this mistake of believing that it's true. Even though it functions that way, that's not what's happened. It's an illusion. So the Buddhist practice is an attempt to overcome the inherent split that our experience reveals to us. And at the thinking level, it's developed this fourfold system. Form is form, emptiness is emptiness. Form is emptiness, emptiness is form. Okay, so you can describe it that way. You can describe it objective-subjective. You can describe it host and guest. There's been lots of different strategies that the teachers have used over the millenniums. To try to focalize our mind into this delusive nature. So you can say it is, you can say it isn't, you can say it both is and isn't, and you can say it neither is nor isn't. This is the logical abstract of the system. It is, it isn't, both is and isn't, and it neither is nor isn't. All four of these things are happening simultaneously. This is the dilemma. It's a four-dimensional thing that's being converted into a one-dimensional thought. and most of the koans can be seen as one expression or another of this fourfold system. The dialogue between the students and the teachers and between the students and the students are all about how to unfold this fourfold dimension in the activity of the present moment. And to do that, you have to shift your consciousness. Your consciousness as it has been developed, our consciousness as it has been developed and trained by society, does not have the capacity to make that turn. This is what a practice is about. This is why you do a spiritual practice. You do a spiritual practice because you want to shift your consciousness into this new place, which is always present even right now, and always has been. But we are not tuned to it because of the way our mind has shaped itself by society. You can actually free yourself from that trap. But you have to believe that you can do it. And this is the problem. We live in a society that doesn't believe that it's possible to do it. And so there's a split in our consciousness between these two layers of our consciousness. A layer of consciousness that says you can't do that because daddy and mommy and my teachers in grade school and college said I couldn't do it. Well, if you want to believe it, yeah, then you live in that world. You live in the world that you believe in. So if you believe in that world, that's the world that's living. You have to believe that it's possible or else the practice won't work. It is silly to do this practice when you don't believe that you can do it. And that's what's happening all the time. And the sole function of the teacher is to, you know, remind you that you can do it. But you don't believe it. And so we end up all being con artists, trying to con you into it. Yeah, well. I'm ready to get into my dysfunctional vehicle and put back into the mountains.
To them, the Buddha's way is inaccessible.